From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Human Hybrids. Thursday night on the program, we will have our Art Bell tribute show. Thursday night, we will have many guests on the program. Art, of course, passed away on Friday. We're going to be dedicating the shows to him for the rest of the year as well. Thursday night, Art Bell tribute show. Here's what's happening. You may have thought that the world had run out of superlatives to describe the misery that Hurricane Maria brought to Puerto Rico. Well, now here's another one, the second largest blackout in history. Since that monster storm slammed into the American Caribbean territory in September of 2017 and heavily damaged the power grid, more than 3.4 billion hours of electricity have been lost there. That makes it the second longest blackout in world history. Passengers on a Southwest Airlines flight from Fort Lauderdale, Florida to New Orleans Saturday prepared for the worst as the plane attempted to land in a storm. The experience was so scary. People were screaming, crying, preparing to die as the pilot flew the plane through severe thunder and lightning. After a failed attempt to land at its destination, the plane rerouted to Panama City, Florida to wait out the storm. According to one passenger, you couldn't see anything. No visibility, nothing. We thought it was over. Those are scary times. The United States and Britain, they've accused Russia of launching cyber attacks on computer routers, firewalls, and other networking equipment used by government agencies, businesses, and critical infrastructure operators around the globe. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned that further Western attacks on Syria could bring chaos to world affairs as Washington prepared to increase pressure on Russia with new economic sanctions. Dr. Jerome Corsi with us, noted author and researcher. Jerry, what do you think of the Syrian situation? Is it going to heat up anymore?
I think at the moment, George, it's not going to have any more attacks by the United States. I think this one attack was the only one that's currently being planned. So in the immediate, I think President Trump made the statement he wanted to make, both to Russia, Putin, and to Iran. We may see some more Israeli attacks. That'll depend upon the build-up of the Syrian forces and Israel's perceived threat to Israel.
Jerry, what's the mood out there in Washington, D.C., where you are?
Oh, I think, George, the mood in Washington whips around moment to moment. Today was dominated a lot by James Comey's book and trying to evaluate before it's published. It'll be out tomorrow, whether it had any real bombshells in it. And except for the media hype on it, it seems like pretty much all the information in the book's already been known. That looks like pretty much a self-justification on the part of Comey. And Washington expects it'll have a couple of days of sensationalism, but won't affect the narrative very much.
Okay, keep in touch, Jerry. Probably talk to you sometime this week. Arizona Senator John McCain underwent surgery during the weekend to treat an intestinal infection. The 81-year-old McCain, who is also battling brain cancer, is said to be in stable condition after being admitted to the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona. R. Lee Emery, a former Marine Corps drill instructor known to millions of moviegoers as the Gunnery Sergeant Hartman in Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket, has died, according to his longtime manager. He was 74 years old. I have had for years a Sergeant R. Lee Emery bobblehead toy, and every once in a while I've played it, and I'm going to do it now. There he goes. He died of pneumonia. He was a great actor. I really enjoyed him. Scientists in Australia have voiced concern about an apparent outbreak of a Borrelia ulcer, it's called, a flesh-eating disease that usually occurs in West and Central Africa. The infectious disease has seen a spike in cases in recent years in several parts of Australia, but particularly in the state of Victoria. A Japanese government-commissioned expert panel has green-lighted controversial scientific experiments to grow human organs inside the bodies of animals as early as next fall. Surgical goggles developed by researchers at the University of Illinois and Washington University are able to spot cancerous tissue where the human eye will not, according to a new study. The goggles, which were tested in mice and women with breast cancer, have integrated cameras that can pick up infrared signals beneath the surface of the tissue. It's amazing what they keep coming up with. In Rome, about 200 aspiring exorcists gathered for a week-long course in casting out demons, including by cell phone if necessary, amid increased demand for the service among Roman Catholics. Participants, many of them priests, will attend lectures and talks on a range of topics, including witchcraft, how to tell the difference between demonic possession and mental illness, and a step-by-step guide to casting out demons. The launch of the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket carrying a NASA planet-hunting spacecraft has been called off to allow more time for additional guidance, navigation, and control analysis there. An asteroid the size of a football field buzzed by Earth on Sunday in one of the closest encounters the planet has seen in a while. At its closest point, the asteroid called 2018 GE3 was just 119,500 miles from Earth's atmosphere, about half the distance between Earth and the Moon. The estimated diameter of the space rock ranged from 131 to 328 feet. It could create lots of damage had it hit. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, George. And speaking of SpaceX, just to give our listeners out there on coast an update on the Red Tesla Roadster. Since it was launched some 68 days ago, it's now some 13.5 million miles away from the Earth, not necessarily heading directly toward the planet Mars, but toward that period or area, we should say, where Mars orbit is. In 2020, it actually will get close to the red planet. And following up on what you said, George, before about this very strange interloper into the solar system near Earth, 2018 GE3, the object, as you described accurately, could be easily upwards of 200 feet, as astronomers talk about it. It's simply, according to many, the largest space rock that's passed the Earth in such a, well, it was discovered actually a day before the close encounter.
Oh, geez.
And that's the thing that's alarming, to say the least. Just remember, folks, back in 1908, June the 30th, the great Tunguska event took place. George, many are saying that this object, safely passing the Earth, thank goodness, was probably equally the size of the Tunguska event, and that making it much larger, 5 to 6 times larger than the Chelyabinsk meteor, an object like in a small asteroid that passed us in 2013.
Scary
Topping
time.
It up, George, in the live sky, people love this, of course, that's what they tell me, and why not? It's great. The new lunation, we have a lunation number 1179, that's when they started keeping track of the whole lunation cycle since January of 1923. What it means, if sky watchers look on Tuesday evening just into the western sky, you'll see the most magnificent with clear skies conjunction of both the thin waxing crescent moon and the beauty of the planet Venus. And George, I know just a few days away till our great event there, you know, obviously we're looking forward to seeing you and everybody there in Scottsdale. But here's another treat. On Saturday evening into Sunday morning, George, one of the best meteor showers of the early part of 2018, the Lyrid shower, takes place. Looking to the northeastern sky, the moon will not interfere. And as long as you have clear skies, enjoy the Lyrid meteor shower. Dr. Sky reminds you always, keep your eyes to the skies and email me at drsky@cox.net.
Thank you, Dr. Sky. And, of course, he was making reference to our fantastic show that we're going to have in Scottsdale, Arizona next week on April 21st. I'll tell you a little bit more about that a little bit later on the program. And welcome back to Coast, George Dory with you. Martin Luther King Jr. was an American Baptist minister and activist who became the most visible person and leader in the civil rights movement from 1954 until his assassination in 1968. He is best known for advancing civil rights through nonviolence and civil disobedience. tactics that his Christian beliefs and the nonviolent activism of Mahatma Gandhi helped inspire.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners, will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream.
In one of the most comprehensive works I've ever seen on the King assassination, Stuart Wexler and Larry Hancock have put together Killing King, an incredible story that we're going to talk about now. Let me introduce both of them. Here's Stuart first. Stuart has long been considered one of the top investigative researchers in domestic terrorism and radical religious activities. His books include Awful Grace of God and America's Secret Jihad. His groundbreaking work on forensics and historical crimes has been featured on NBC News and the Boston Globe, Newsweek, USA Today, and he teaches in New Jersey, where he won the prestigious James Madison Teachers Fellowship back several years ago. Stuart Wexler. Stuart, welcome to the program. I'm really looking forward to this with you tonight.
Hi, thank you for having us on.
And let's introduce Larry Hancock. Larry's considered also one of the top investigative researchers in the areas of intelligence and national security. He is the author of several books, including Shadow Warfare and Surprise Attack. His books have received endorsements and praise from former White House Select Committee on Investigation staff members and the former Joint Historian for the State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency as well. Welcome, Larry Hancock, to the program. Hi, Larry.
I'm happy to be here.
Likewise. Both of you put together just a marvelous book, Killing Kennedy, a subject I have investigated and looked at for years. I've had William Pepper on for years, who still contends that James Earl Ray did not do it, a theory that is somewhat is in yours, where you believe he was part of it, but you have uncovered some incredible stuff. Let's start with you first, Stuart, and then Larry, and then both jump in anytime you want. How did you begin to investigate this case?
Well, I was helping Larry with in investigation into the Robert Kennedy assassination, and we had started to look at a certain set of suspects that somebody else had implicated in RFK's murder, and we looked into it and we dismissed it there. But what we found was some intriguing evidence to suggest that these people, Kathy Ainsworth and Tommy Terrence, too, terrorists from Mississippi, racial terrorists, that they had something to do with the King assassination. And that sort of took us down a journey that had many different, almost independent angles that kept on aligning with each other and aligning on this idea, as we explore in our book, that this was almost an act of religious terrorism, of white supremacist terrorism against Martin Luther King.
And would you agree, Larry, when you began to investigate this case, you started uncovering some pretty strange facts?
We did, and one of the things that we began to uncover was that actually the FBI investigation and now Select Committee investigation had turned up some fascinating leads and suspects that could be taken a lot further. And we were kind of amazed that their investigation hadn't gone nearly as far as it should have.
I knew a reporter in St. Louis, John Aubel, who knew the brothers of James Earl Ray quite well. He always believed that either James Earl Ray did not do it or definitely was one of the minor players in that situation. You two conclude almost the same thing now, don't you?
Yes, we do. I would say it's fair that everything that you can learn about James Earl Ray and about his life would lead you to believe that he was not a racial terrorist, a radical of that sort, an assassin. But the one constant that comes out of it all is that James Earl Ray was always on the lookout for money. And that's what we think that he found in the Kennedy assassination and followed up on a bounty offer that he'd actually heard about while in prison.
Why did he plead guilty to the assassination?
Basically, his lawyer convinced him that a guilty plea was the only thing that would get him out of a death sentence. And he was scared of a death penalty, but he really wasn't serious about the plea, because after he made the plea and was convicted, he immediately recanted and asked for a new trial.
Yeah, he did. He did. And it, the family of Martin Luther King Jr. has always believed that James Earl Ray was not the assassin, correct?
They believe that. They largely believe a particular version of what happened that day. And, you know, the evidence in Memphis on the surface is certainly muddled and inconclusive as to who the identity of the actual shooter is. But what we contend, though, is if you use some common sense and logic, it becomes a clearer avenue as to what may have happened there. The big picture being that you have to try and resolve two things, that it doesn't seem like if it was just one guy, say James Earl Ray, that it was a well-planned out assassination. We're talking the actual day, mm-hmm. not necessarily overall. But on the other hand, it doesn't look like it's a very well-planned out or well-thought-out assassination if it was a conspiracy. So our book, Killing King, tries to thread that needle. How do you explain the sort of contradictions in both of those insights?
Immediately after the assassination, the FBI felt that there might have been multiple suspects. How did we end up with just the single shooters program again?
That's really interesting, and actually that offered us a great opportunity, because unlike the Kennedy assassination or RFK's assassination, the FBI started coming across multiple names, and as they turned out, they were aliases. But for some weeks, they really thought that they were looking at a conspiracy involving several people, and it was a much more open investigation than we see in the others. And that's why we ended up with a lot of leads that were really worth pursuing, because even though the attorney general and the FBI director had shut it down publicly early on to one person to kind of cope with the violence that was going on, they kept it open for some weeks. And they only closed it down to one person, as they always do, when they came up with sufficient forensic crime scene evidence to point to an individual. And once they felt that they could make a case against that one individual, things closed down, and they began dropping the other leads that would have pointed towards conspiracy.
And if I could add that real quick, you've got to remember that right after King's murder, there are mass riots. So there is a big incentive to close down open questions and give a nice, well-packaged answer as soon as humanly possible, to try and pacify the country.
Well, that is true. Now, in April of 68, when he was assassinated, 2 months later, the so-called assassin, James Earl Ray, was picked up and captured in London, England. How in the heck did he get there?
That's really a fascinating story, and that goes along with the quandary that we've encountered. It's sort of, if you look at the attack itself, it makes no sense at all as having been planned, because Ray takes all the stuff into this rooming house that he didn't need to if he was planning on it. And yet when he escapes leaving lots of stuff at the crime scene, goes back to Atlanta where he had a room where other stuff is, then escapes by bus, which, you know, doesn't reflect a very well-planned escape.
No.
And then he has no money. That's the other factor in all of this. And James Earl Ray himself said, you know, if I just had some money, I would have been able to buy a ticket all the way through England to Africa, and I would have been away from extradition. He didn't have enough money. He was so strapped for money that he even had to commit bank robbery in England to try to come up with the money for a ticket. But he was only picked up in England because it took him so long to blunder through this protracted escape.
Do you think he knew what was happening in terms of the assassination?
We think he knew the big pictures of things. And again, I mean, if you read our book, we have a unique interpretation of what happened in Memphis itself.
Right.
We think he knew the big picture, but he actually didn't know certain other things that, namely, who to go to, for instance, if you wanted the money.
All right, stay with us, both of you. Stuart Wexler, Larry Hancock, the name of the book, Killing King. More in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, as Dr. Sky was alluding to, we've got our live stage show coming up this coming Saturday in Scottsdale, Arizona. It is fantastic to be out that way. Virginia G. Piper Theater, April 21st. Meet and greet thereafter. Lots of guests, including one of my favorites, Travis Walton. You might remember that case. 1975, while working with a logging crew in Arizona, he was apparently abducted by a UFO. Travis is one heck of a guy, and he's going to be one of our main guests. Travis, I'm looking forward to meeting you again.
Yeah, that's going to be great. Can you hear me okay?
Barely. You must be out logging again.
I'm really looking forward to this. This is going to be great. You know, it's a great panel of characters, a cast of people, and I'm feeling a lot better about my experience, you know, in terms of interpreting what it all meant. And I've got a lot of new perspectives on things.
Well, we're going to look forward to it, and you're going to announce those new perspectives at our Scottsdale event. Travis sounded like he was up in the UFO talking to me, as a matter of fact. But we're going to have a great show. How do you get your tickets there? Don't be left out, because they are flying out the window. Just go to coasttocoastam.com, click either in our carousel reel or at the top of the homepage, events, and that'll take you straight to get the tickets. Remember the date, because you have to get into it through their calendar, April 21st. And then on June 9th at the Silverton Casino in Las Vegas, whoa, another live stage show, including with our friend and talk show host and our great journalist out there in Las Vegas, George Knapp. He'll be one of our guests as well. And again, a meet and greet after that. There is a phone number to call the Silverton directly at 702-263-7777. Hit number 4. That's 702-263-7777. Or go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, and click the events. And then you click the Las Vegas event as well. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We are back with Stuart Wexler and Larry Hancock talking about their work, Killing King. Stuart, would you explain for us the House Select Committee on Assassinations and what their role has been in the past?
So the House Select Committee on Assassinations was a temporary committee formed by Congress in the late 1970s to reinvestigate both the King assassination and the Kennedy assassination. And they uncovered in both cases a lot of new leads and new information, and we believe in both cases didn't fully follow through on the information they uncovered. And so they've been sort of the go-to group for a lot of people who are investigators into both assassinations to really dig deeper into both crimes. And in both cases, it's worth noting, they did conclude that there was a probable conspiracy in both the Kennedy assassination and the King assassination.
And with those conclusions, why did it seem to just stop right there? Why wasn't there an investigation in both cases?
Well, there were referrals made to the Justice Department, but things really started to stall. And over time, there were efforts to try and discredit some of the conspiracy findings, for instance, in the Kennedy assassination, an effort to attack the acoustics evidence. In the case of the King assassination, you were dealing probably with a lot vaguer of a notion of who was behind the crime. They did give some indications that they thought it was some people out of St. Louis, but they didn't have the sort of definitiveness, for lack of a better term, that they offered in the case of the Kennedy assassination. So there wasn't really the political will, I guess you would say. In fact, there was probably more political will to try and put that genie back in the bottle.
Mm-hmm. I get it. Now, Larry, tell us, what were some of these main indications of a conspiracy that the committee looked at?
Well, I think the key is they found very concrete evidence of a large bounty from a very specific group, a southern group The bounty was $100,000, and it was being circulated to select people in certain prisons. And they started tracking down the evidence of that bounty, and they actually found evidence that Ray knew about it, that he was interested in it, that he had discussed it. He had even referred it to a young man who was getting out and going back to Atlanta because Ray was in for years, and he couldn't take advantage of it. And that was the starting point. And the problem was they discovered a lot of other things that would have fleshed out that story and that bounty, but they didn't have the evidence and really couldn't see the leads that Stu and I were able to see with the FBI documents that became available later. So they kind of sketched out the framework, but they couldn't connect the dots, and that's kind of where we came in.
And you both name names in this book, Killing King.
We do, and we can be pretty specific because the leads point to individuals, Sam Bowers, who is the leader of the White Knights, certain of his inner circle members. Another thing that allowed us to name names was Stu did some great legwork and actually uncovered an individual that had reported this bounty to the FBI and himself got involved in carrying some of the money unknowingly from Atlanta to Mississippi that was to be used in the bounty payment.
And, of course, Bowers is dead, dying about 12 years ago. Wasn't he also charged or convicted with other murders, too?
Oh, yes. Bowers was one of the things, again, that pulls it together. Bowers' group can now confirm they had been trying to kill King for some 4 years. And they were doing other acts of racial violence, but his group was actually convicted in the Mississippi Burning murders of the civil rights workers in Mississippi, and they were tied to a variety of violent acts and designated by the FBI as the most violent racist group in the United States.
And when you were starting to do your research, how did you point yourself toward Bowers as one of the lead characters in this thing?
Well, there's sort of three different, like, trails that all independently, when you follow them, wind up at Bowers' doorstep. There's that individual that Larry had referenced named Don Nissen, who gave information to the FBI about a bounty offer that was being fronted by the White Knights. That could have been investigated much further than it was, and if you do, you get to Sam Bowers. There is the evidence that I discussed at the very beginning of the show from the self-described chief terrorist for the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, who is, by the way, still alive, who's on tape saying he got a rifle to shoot Martin Luther King 2 weeks before the assassination. He had been obviously working very closely with Sam Bowers. And then finally, there's this there are reports, and this is really what the HSCA was looking at, of strange activity at a place in Mississippi that was a gathering point for the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And if you follow all three leads, and that's what we do in the book, it really aligns quite well. And in fact, if they had been more competent, more thorough, both before and certainly after the assassination, we may have actually prevented the assassination, but we certainly could have figured out who was behind it. They just needed to connect the dots the way Larry had described earlier.
Who do you think the shooter might have been?
That's where we're going to run into some controversy. We were a little bit vague about this in the beginning, but we actually think that the best explanation, although it's not as definitive for us as other things in the case, is that what happened was that James Earl Ray was involved on the periphery for most of the crime. They didn't have any intention of James Earl Ray being a shooter. But we ultimately believe that James Earl Ray literally and figuratively jumped the gun in hopes of getting a larger share of the bounty. And if you read the book, we give, again, that the physical evidence is not nearly as definitive as it would be in other cases that you would hope But in terms of the logic of it, that is what really helps make sense of Memphis. And no, it's a controversial claim. We just ask the people who are listening to have that same open mind that you insisted of the person who called who was skeptical of UFO sightings. So I think if you keep an open mind and read our sort of justification for it, you may wind up being convinced of something that you might not otherwise have been convinced of.
And Stuart and Larry, I've always been baffled at why Martin Luther King Jr. was on the balcony at his hotel at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. And then the shooter was conveniently set up out there. That has always been strange to me. Any thoughts on that?
And the part of that we can certainly, Dr. King actually, and unfortunately, had been out on the balcony a couple of times. He was staying in the motel room. He'd been having meetings all day long, and he was about to go out for dinner.
And this wasn't like a Vegas suite or anything. It was just a small room, wasn't it?
It's the sort of motel that we older folks are used to, two-story motel, railing on the second floor, individual rooms all opening out. So, no, not at all. And so he had gone out to check with the person who was going to drive him to dinner, and they were ready, and then gone back in to get his coat, and he was just standing there for the second time. And we have a record of this because he was actually being observed by a police officer taking notes across the street at a fire station. So we even know the exact timing of the shooting. And there's no doubt that he was shot from across the street. We just, unfortunately, they did not do a good autopsy. We don't have a very good trajectory for the shot, so it's impossible to say much more than it came from across the street. But as Stu was saying, one of the problems with this whole thing is that if James Earl Ray had been fully in tune to setting up and doing this assassination, he was in the wrong place for it. His room that he got did not have a good view, especially good shooting view. You could use binoculars and see across the street, but getting a rifle in the window and taking a shot was a problem, which, nominally speaking, he ended up using the bathroom down the hall. But it's all very strange because he took all of his stuff into the room. Apparently, he was going to stay the night. Stu and I think he was there to turn the rifle over to someone else, and the attack was actually going to occur on live TV the next day, which would have been a tremendous incitement to racial violence.
Oh, my God, it would have been unbelievable. The witnesses that were on the balcony with him, the two of them that I know of for sure, Jesse Jackson and the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, he's dead now. Jackson's alive. There was one other person out there, right?
There were I think, maybe five people, Stu, that actually were in the area.
Yeah, because Andrew Young was definitely in the area. You had Merrill McCullough, who kind of flew up there, and we could talk maybe a little bit of him. He's a little bit of a suspicious character, but maybe not as suspicious as as history has labeled on him. So there was about four or five.
When this was all done, when the assassination occurred, could the FBI have continued its investigation and come to the conclusions you two have come to now?
I think they could have, and I think Stu would agree with me. If they had not been shut off and essentially, you know, let the prosecution focused on Ray, if they'd done an open-ended, one of the things that we found, strangely enough, is that it was so compartmentalized. The FBI has never had a good way to share data between its field offices, and so one field office was seeing things and generating reports that another field office couldn't see. So a suspect that looks very important to us because we can tie crimes together over a number of years and with these same people, the individual field offices couldn't see it, and quite frankly, there was no one in charge of the whole thing overall because the Justice Department wasn't really participating because Hoover didn't want them to.
No, and Hoover seems to have touched everything. He was there for Kennedy's assassination in office. heading up the FBI, and he was there for Bobby Kennedy's and Martin Luther King's. And he seemed to have done a poor job getting any of those cases done.
Well, if I could chime in here, I think one of the things that is new in our book that people who've looked at our past stuff online and in the earlier work that we have done might not see is there may have been, we've come further along in thinking that there may have been an ulterior motive, not necessarily one of, you know, malicious intent, but FBI had informants all over the place. And by this point in time, they had informants high up in many different organizations that were white supremacist organizations, all the kinds of organizations that they were surveilling. And we think there's pretty good reason to believe that they had an informant very high up in at least one, possibly more, in the White Knights. And that's going to create all kinds of problems. It's a Whitey Bulger type of situation where why didn't you jump on this thing earlier? Why didn't you know more about it? To what extent did that person actually have criminal culpability in the crime? So we believe that there's an element of the cover-up there that we explore in Killing King that I think definitely needs to be looked into.
Do you think the public today could handle the truth if, you know, this book of yours, Killing King, became so mainstream and that the government came out and agreed with it that, yes, there were other players involved and they're all dead now? No need pursuing, but yes, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated by a group of people. It was a conspiracy. Do you think the public can accept that?
I think they could because I think they've come to understand terror attacks because of what we've been through in the past couple of, you know, they understand radicals, religious radicalism, people that are obsessed, people that are trying to, you know, create mass terror and panic. I think they're much more likely to accept that now than they were back then.
Okay, Stu, go ahead.
The only thing that I think would take some adjustment is it's a little bit of a different style of terrorist than people are used to dwelling upon, and we explore that. But I think if they can wrap their heads around that, as Larry said, it shouldn't be that surprising to them that people try provocative acts of violence to advance a political cause.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back and take phone calls as we talk about the incredible work, Killing King, on Coast to Coast AM.